Welcome to Inside the Treehouse, a conversation with world-class K-12 education experts who will talk about their personal journey and all things education. I'm Jeff Jones, and our podcast is brought to you by Solution Tree, the home of some of the greatest tested and proven solutions to problems we face daily in K-12 education. And today's guest, Dr. Bob Aker, whom I met in 1998, right after my business partner and I took over Solution Tree, which was then National Educational Service. And he and his dear friend Rick DeFore had recently published a book called Professional Learning Communities at Work. So today's episode, which is going to be part of a series of conversations with Bob, is going to be the beginning of a beautiful friendship, both personally and professionally, about his relationship with Rick DeFore over the years. But prior to your relationship with Rick, Bob, and welcome to the show, let's go a little bit about your history, how you got into education, because it wasn't your intent to go right into education. You went into the Marine Corps.
Yeah, I had a circuitous route, I think, into education. I had joined the Marine Corps, and when I was in the Marines, I was assigned to a Navy admiral, David Bell, who was in charge of the Polaris submarine fleet in Holy Loch, Scotland. And much of my time, I would just spend standing around until he told me to go get this, do that, or whatever. And so he got the idea that rather than waste that time, I should read books. And so he had a little podium made for me and gave me books. He'd give me a book to read, and I'd stand there and read. But what was really interesting about it, then when I'd have to drive him somewhere, he would quiz me about the books, and we'd talk about the books. I knew I had to read them and pay attention. But I really realized how much I enjoy reading, and particularly history. And so when I got out of the Marines, I went back to the university, finished up on the GI Bill, but I majored in history. And I really enjoyed my history classes. And, of course, everybody told me there are no jobs for teachers in history. You'll never get a job. You'll never, you know. And not only did I get a job, I got a job at a great high school in Chattanooga. So it was, and I loved teaching. I absolutely loved it. I never once dreaded going to work. I went into teaching and then assistant principal there at that high school, and I just thought it was the greatest thing that pay you to spend time with young people and be around young people. And so that was a terrific thing for me. That's how I kind of got into the whole teaching thing. I didn't have an epiphany one day and said, hey, I want to raise test scores for kids. I mean, it was more like I just love teaching. I love my content. I love the kids. And so, yeah, it was great.
So you're in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And you had met your wife, Star.
Right, yeah.
And then you went on to get a master's degree at UT?
Well, University of Chattanooga. University of Chattanooga was a private liberal arts school there in Chattanooga, and highly respected, really good liberal. But like a lot of liberal arts schools, they kind of struggle financially from time to time. So the University of Tennessee system took them over, bought them out, and whatever. So when I got my master's degree, it was at the University of Chattanooga, but by then you could say, well, I got my master's from the University of Tennessee or the University of Chattanooga. I must tell you, I take great pride in the fact that I got my degree from the University of Chattanooga, my undergraduate degree and master's degree. I thought it was a great school, and great people, and I do have really, really high regards for small liberal arts school, although I spent my career at a large public university.
Yeah. And so then following your master's degree, you were still teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
And when did you start getting into writing?
Well, I really got into that in two ways. Because I'd been such an avid reader, I always had back in my mind, I kind of like to write something. We had a local person, representative, I guess, or anyway, his name was Bill Brock. He was a politician from Tennessee in Washington. And I volunteered to help write some things for his campaign, speeches and things. I doubt if they were ever used. But anyway, I started writing there. Then when I went off to get my doctorate at the University of Tennessee, my major professor and chair of the department, who had a tremendous influence on my life. His name was Jerry Bellin. And I started writing some things with Jerry and a colleague, Jim Huffman. And so we wrote a little book on clinical supervision. So that was my first tip, putting my toe in the water in writing. And I must say, I took to writing like a duck to water. I don't know that I'm very good at it, but I've certainly spent many years doing it.
Well, I think 33 books later, you can say you're pretty good at it.
Well, I do it. Let's put it that way. I did that. And then every book that I would have something to do with, at the end, I would always tell my wife, that's it. I'm not going to do another one. You know, one more. So I finally just accepted the fact that one of the things I do in life is write. So, it was a gradual thing. It wasn't a life plan, that's for sure.
And that took you into speaking, speaking at conferences and events.
I've always been skeptical of people who say I'm a self-made man or I'm a self-made person, a self-made woman. But I think all of us are the result of encounters with others, and rarely are they planned. But at the University of Tennessee, when I was there, like I say, my major professor and became a dear friend and kind of a professional father to me was my department chair. His name, I mentioned, was Jerry Bellin. And Jerry had come to the University of Tennessee from Berkeley. And when he was in California, he was doing quite a bit of consulting work with public schools, K-12 schools. And so when he came to Knoxville, since I was his graduate assistant, in addition to being a student, he would take me with him on these consulting trips. And it started with me mainly just going, and I'd maybe present a little bit, but very little. But as the time went by, he increasingly would give me more responsibility for speaking and consulting, to get to the point where then he's sending me by myself to do that. And just like with writing, those early, small, incremental things, over time, you build your confidence and you realize that people want to hear about some things you have to say. I think I was pretty good in the way I said it, too. I think that's important. And so I began to get a lot of people beginning to ask me to speak at, like, state conferences or things. And then, you couple that with writing, and somebody will read a book or publishing or whatever. And so you begin to incrementally build a reputation through, I think, a combination of presenting and writing. They both together, I can't support each other.
You have a great demeanor on stage and comforting. I mean, I've watched you keynote and present hundreds of times. And every time, as I watch the crowds and audience, they all feel as if you're talking right to them. You're telling them personal stories and you make them laugh. But the content is enriching as they come out of it. So you've got a great presentation style.
I've always thought that the word presenting wasn't a very good word, because people who present come across as sort of a canned. They even get into a voice sometimes that sounds not genuine because it's a sort of canned presentation.
Right.
And I think a really great presenter is just teaching to a larger class. You're just teaching, but it's just a larger class rather than a high school class. So, and I've never been nervous presenting. That's the most interesting thing, I would think, coming from a small rural town with my southern accent and not very sophisticated on things. And you'd think I'd just be a nervous wreck, but I have never, ever been nervous presenting. And I think part of that really goes back to my training in the Marines. People always say to me, on different jobs I've had, or different, like a dean or vice president, provost, or speaking jobs, consulting jobs, people say, well, aren't you nervous about that? And I always chuckle inside, saying, no, after you've been in the Marines for 3 or 4 years, this is nothing. I mean, really, this is nothing. Let me help you here. Paris Island, yeah, that'll make you nervous, but, you know.
Well, in your memoir that we recently wrote and we published, you talk about relationships and how a relationship can change the trajectory of your life. And one of those relationships came from one of your speaking engagements way back when. And that's when you met Rick DeFore.
Yeah, that I kind of think of my relationship with Rick and with you, Jeff, as sort of a phrase I think I used in the book was accidental friendships. You don't plan these things to happen. But in 1978, I was a professor at Middle Tennessee State University. And again, my friend Jerry Bellin, he would put on summer leadership conferences in Knoxville and invite people mainly from Long Island and Chicago, young educators, to come to the leadership conference. It lasted 3 or 4 days, and Jerry had asked me to come up and speak at that leadership conference on the research on teaching effectiveness, or I guess technically the teaching effects research. But anyway, I was speaking, and when I finished, this young fellow comes up to me and introduces himself, Rick DeFore. I'm from West Chicago High School in Chicago, and I was wondering if you would be willing to come up and talk to my faculty about this research on effective teaching. And I did. I went up, and that night we went out to eat, and I just thought Rick was a people who never knew Rick or didn't get the opportunity to experience Rick, the power of his personality and his wit and his humor and his intellect, just really just amazing. So we hit it off, and then I went to Chicago, and that just led to 40 years of a wonderful, wonderful friendship. It would be impossible for me to reflect on my professional life, and to a great degree my personal life, and think of it in the singular, like my life. Most of my professional life and parts of my personal life was always Bob and Rick. I mean, there was rarely a day that we didn't communicate either by email or text or phone, and certainly by phone 2 or 3 times a week. And those conversations weren't about anything particular, just chat and laugh and talk and what you're doing and what you're reading and, hey, did you ever think about this? And why don't we do this? Or, hey, we need to write that down. You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah. And of course, you add the third leg of the piece there. I know you might be reluctant to bring this up, but although Rick and I had worked a long time, the same thing happened with you. And when Rick and I met you, what happened to Rick and me happened to the two of us when we met you. So it was just amazingly serendipitous how all that happened.
It's been a great friendship and a good run.
Yeah.
So I believe it's true that I think Rick told me one time that you're the only consultant that he ever brought.
I've heard him say that, and I've heard other people. I don't have a clue about that. But I know that with Rick's sense of self-confidence, Rick wasn't lacking in self-confidence, that if I wasn't the only one, I was one of the few. Because most of the things Rick thought he could do himself in
right.
terms of leadership.
Well, he did a lot of reading, as you did, and I know that, I believe that the early stages of what you two started to work on was built off of what Shirley Horde and Mildred McLaughlin and Bill Summers had written earlier, and Larry Lazant and Ron Edmonds about effective schools. Is that the foundational research?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Rick and I never, ever claimed to come up with the term professional learning communities. That's simply not true. We never claimed that. I think what we tried to do was come up with practical applications of the concepts and practices you'd see in a school that functioned as a high-performing professional learning community. But prior to that, the sort of incremental steps of that went like this. The big thing in the late 70s, early 80s, all across the country, was the term clinical supervision. And the whole idea was if you would go in and objectively watch teachers teach, I think the technical term would be using ethnographic techniques like they do in anthropology and make non-judgmental notes about what you see and then sit down with the teacher and recreate the lesson, essentially the issues, what went well, what didn't go so well, how would you make this class better, that sort of thing. I became really involved in that at the University of Tennessee. And Rick was getting training in that and became, as you would expect, just a master at observing teachers. But when I began to go up to Michigan State University and we began to better understand the specific teacher behaviors that will have effect either positively or negatively on student learning and behavior, we were able to connect that with observing teachers. And the reason that's important because is this, and it's still a big issue today, I think. I think observing teachers in and of itself might be nice, but what if a teacher says, "You're right, I didn't do a very good job. What do you think I should do to improve my teaching?" So if you don't have that knowledge base of specific teaching behaviors, right, mm-hmm. That can have a positive effect on students, you're left saying, "Well, geez, I don't know. I just, my job here is just to observe. You know, I'm great at observing, but hey, I can't help you with any of the how to get better." And so Rick and I began to connect that research on teaching to the observing teachers, the clinical supervision thing. Right. But when I was going up to Michigan State, and gosh, I'm greatly indebted to Judy Lanier, the dean there. The chairman of the Department of Ed Administration was Larry Lazat, and he was involved in some of that early research on the teaching effects research. And so I got to know Larry that way. And then, of course, when Ron Edmonds came over to Michigan State with the effective schools research, which is just an extension, really, of the effective teaching research, in other words, what school behaviors affect.
He came from Harvard, right?
Came from Harvard, came to Michigan State. And, of course, I knew Larry, that we began to see, Rick and I began to see how all this began was really just a whole part of school, how to improve a school.
Mm-hmm.
How to improve a school from a kid to a school to a district and so forth. So, we became very involved in the effective schools movement. I did in particular because I was working at the university and I had much more flexibility of time than Rick did. Rick, principal at Adlai Stevenson then, 4,000 students approximately.
And you're at Middle Tennessee State.
I'm at Middle Tennessee State. So I was more into writing and research and also consulting. And Larry and I began, when Ron Edmonds passed away, as most people know, at a very young age.
In 48.
Late 40s, yeah. And so Larry kind of picked up that mantle. And so Larry and I and other people, I don't claim to be the only ones here, but started consulting together, writing together. I used to write the research critiques for the effective school products, research critiques. And of course, Rick was very interested in that. But what was really interesting to me is this relationship between a university professor and a school practitioner, Rick. Because
right.
While I was able to think through all the different research studies, their implications for effective schools, and write about it, Rick was able to try them out in his school. It was actually, I had a great lab, when you think about it, Adlai Stevens. So that combination, and Rick used to talk about this quite a bit when we were first getting started, that combination between a writer, researcher, professor type and a highly motivated and intelligent school practitioner, I think was one of just fortunate things in both our lives. It gave us a real laboratory. I always thought of Stevenson as a laboratory. We'd try everything, and it was mainly implementing the effective schools research. So that did form the basis then. The professional learning communities became nothing more than a collection of best practices around a collaborative culture. And so that was just sort of the next logical step, building on the work of Shirley Horde and others.
Right. So when you started, so you said you met in 78, you were doing the effective schools research with Larry and then or Ron and then Larry in the early 80s. And you started implementing these things at Stevenson High School after Rick had left from West Chicago to Stevenson. What was it like in the early stages? Because you couldn't go to a conference to learn about professional learning communities. You couldn't read books about professional learning communities. You couldn't listen to podcasts about professional learning communities. So this is all brand new to teachers. Everything that you guys are bringing in, at least from a larger scale than just a single classroom.
You know, during that period of time, and I'll say roughly from the time Rick moved over to Stevenson and the effective teaching, effective schools research, Rick and I, and there was a period probably of 15 years there that we would together consult. We'd go, people would, because we'd write an article here and there, and people would call us and say, would you present at our district, or we're having a retreat, would you guys come, or whatever. So we did a great deal of presenting together, and places like ASCD, National Staff Development Council, and things. And what people don't realize sometimes about presenting is really the first step of presenting, writing, because you have to put together, whether it's transparencies or PowerPoints, you've got to think about, well, what are we going to say? And it was in that sort of process of thinking about, well, what are we going to share with these people, that essentially what we were sharing was the practical sort of things that worked at Stevenson or didn't work, or other schools would see work. So in many ways, I remember we were going to write one of our early books, and we thought we should just name it, title it Common Sense. Because I do think if there was anything about our presenting and writing at that time that was a little unique, was I think people would hear us present and think of the things we're doing that Rick was doing at Stevenson. And people in the audience or people who are reading our books would say, they say, well, I can do that. I mean, that just makes sense. You know, take, for example, I'll just give you a quick example. It's amazing at that time what a revolutionary idea it was to say that if you want more kids to learn more, you've got to be crystal clear on what you want them to learn in the first place. Now, that sounds like a farmer in Indiana would have enough, you know, to say, if you want kids to learn, what do you got to do? Well, you got to know what you want them to learn. I mean, you know?
Right.
But we had made school improvement so complicated and so technical and so full of research jargon and vocabulary that I think if you look at professional learning communities at work, that book, I think one of the things that made that book attractive to educators was it was doable. It was written in a language that was easily understood, and it just made a lot of common sense. So I think our sort of our development came from 15 years of presenting to groups all across the United States. And we'd do that together, interesting enough. It wasn't where Rick would stand up, present, and sit down, then I'd stand up and present. We had one set of one presentation, and we'd do it together. And people who, they were also, I think, very witty and relaxing and fun. And
one of the first times I do that. One of the first times I saw you present was in, I think it was in Nashville, Tennessee. I went with you and Rick, and you were at a leadership.
Yeah, we did about 4 years of leadership, 3 or 4 years of leadership training in Tennessee for the state of Tennessee. They'd come to Murfreesboro, and Rick and I'd put on about a week-long leadership training thing. And in addition to the content, it's great fun. Rick would, you know, teach people the Macarena, or we'd go out to a karaoke at night. And by the time people left at the end of the week, they had had a great time in addition to learning a lot. So we got great reviews. And I've always thought, as popular as the professional learning community institutes are, part of that has to do with sort of the influence of, let's make this highly informative, highly efficient, but also let's make it participant friendly.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And people who come to the professional learning community institutes will, some come back four, five, six times and bring in other groups and things. And I think they just find it as just a different experience than maybe some of the other professional conferences they go to.
So when you and Rick were presenting together in those early days, I mean, my recollection or memory was how smooth the transition, how well you guys worked together. And I'm assuming that the way that you were in presentations together led to your writing styles together.
Exactly. Rick could be a brutal critic when it comes to writing. Other people have said to Rick, they'd send him something and say, would you read this? Tell me what you think. Give me some feedback. And if you didn't have a strong self-concept, it could hurt your feelings probably. But I never had that experience with Rick. When we would present, it was really, we planned no transitions. We had a great deal of self-confidence. I mean, maybe some people say we had too much, but it was easy for us to just say, well, somebody asked a question, I'd answer it, and I'd say, what do you think, Rick? Or, you know, whatever. There was no sense that we didn't plan transitions or anything. We could just together talk to people. And that's the way we wrote. And I think we're tremendous. It's hard. Co-authoring is very difficult. But it wasn't for us, because essentially what we were writing on paper was the way we talked daily. Sure. And so it was easy for us. And Rick, and you would know this, Jeff, Rick was a tremendous writer in the sense that I have this image of Rick in my mind. I'm standing at my kitchen sink looking out the back window, and Rick's laying out there in a hammock with a yellow legal pad. And it's just going like crazy. And you could take that legal pad, I promise you, and type it up and publish it. You wouldn't have to do anything to it. He was a tremendous writer like that.
You two are a publisher's dream, believe me. When the manuscript comes in, it's a lot easier to publish than quite a few of them that we get, where we have to do a lot more developmental editing, like 3 years of developmental editing versus yeah. 3 minutes of developmental yeah. editing with you guys. So tell me about your first book that you wrote, the first book that you wrote together.
Our first book really stemmed from an article we wrote. I can't tell you exactly who it was for, but the title of it, I remember distinctly. It was called How Effective Leaders Get Results. I forget where it was published, but this organization, I don't know, it was AASA or somebody like that. And it was voted one of the top 10 articles of the year. And it sort of laid out the foundation, really, pieces of a PLC, but that word didn't exist back then. But it's How Effective Leaders Get Results. So we get this phone call, Rick does, from this guy in New York who had a publishing company and wanted to know if we would be interested in writing a book, and he would publish it. And Rick called me, and we thought, well, yeah, let's do that. So we wrote a book. This was in the age of the excellence movement. And the reason this is funny, I think, is remember the book In Search of Excellence?
Absolutely.
That was a big book, Peters and Waterman. So this guy insisted, here's the only requirement he had, that in the title we had to have the word excellence. And I would say, well, here's one. Lust for excellence. What would you lust for excellence? Or, that way we were just having a great time playing. But we ended up writing a book called Pursuing the Promise of Excellence. beautiful book, hardback book.
I have a copy of it at home.
Yeah, it came out. And the interesting thing about that is who reads a book? I'm sure if you're a publisher, you ask that question. The issue is how many people read the book. I mean, how many people buy the book? But from an author's point of view, it's amazing sometimes who reads the book. And here's our experience that happened to us. There was a state senator in Idaho from Caldwell, Idaho, around that area. And I think he had a background in education. How he got a copy of that book, I don't know. But he was really taken with it. And he thought it was really made a lot of sense. And so he talked to the superintendents in a couple of his districts there, and they had us out to Idaho a number of times. That's where I met Marianne Reynolds, as you know. She was assistant superintendent in Napa, Idaho. So Rick and I started doing a lot of consultant work as a result of that book. And I don't think it was a big seller, but the people who did read it, it opened doors for us to expand our exposure to other groups, things like that.
So that book then was not a huge seller, but then it was picked up and it became another book.
Yeah, what happened, I think National Educational Service was formed. And
it started back in 1987, so it had been around a while.
Yeah, around 87. Anyway, the gist was that I think the publisher in New York went out of business, whatever. So Rick and I had gotten the copyrights back from that book. So we owned the copyrights, pursuing the promise of excellence. And so a few years had gone by. And so we wrote a book for National Educational Service called Creating the New American School, which had most of the content came from pursuing the promise of excellence. We cut it down, reframed it a bit, but the gist of that was, so the first book, and that book did better than pursuing the promise of excellence. And, but that was Creating the New American School. That was the first book with
National Educational Service.
And that did pretty well. So immediately we were asked to start working on another book. I was a little reluctant. You talk about those points in your life where you crossroads that could have gone either way. By then, I was dean of the College of Education. And that was the largest college of education in the state of Tennessee. We produced about a fourth of Tennessee's teachers. And I mean, just administratively, it was a big job. I had, I think, five or six different departments and degrees and programs. And so I was really busy. And the phone rang, and it was Rick, and we were talking. He said, look, I've been thinking about this book we might want to write. And I said, well, what are you thinking, Rick? And he said, well, you know, everything we've been doing over the last 15 years fits under this sort of work they're doing now in professional learning communities, that concept. And we could put it all together under that concept, and here's how it would fit together. What do you think? And I remember distinctly, I'm sitting at my desk and papers piled up, and called this person. And I thought, I need this like a hole in the head. So I could just easily said, you know, Rick, why don't you just do that or get somebody else to help you? I just can't do it right now. But instead, sure, let's do that. So that was how all that came about. But we were both, in addition to writing and presenting, extremely busy in our full-time day job.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. Stevenson was no small operation with that large of high school and great expectations for a very competitive area of the West Chicago suburbs. And so
Rick Superintendent and Dean have a few things on their plates.
Yeah, and so we were busy, but we did that, and we would meet. I would either fly up Chicago. It was Rick's wife worked for American Airlines, and Rick traveled. Anyway, they were able to get good deals on traveling. So a lot of times I would fly up to Chicago, or sometimes Stark go with me, but usually it was just I'd fly up. And I was doing consulting work in Chicago too. So that gave us a chance to, you know, we'd be working on a chapter and we'd meet somewhere and talk, go out to dinner. And then Rick would fly down to Nashville and spend the day with, I'd pick him up at the airport. You know, it's just an hour and a half flight. So he'd fly early down. And, you know, I'd pick him up at 8:30, 9 o'clock. We'd go over to the Opryland Hotel in the lobby, find us a, you know, or in a bar, and find us a nice working place, get a couple of cups of coffee and our yellow legal pads and brainstorm and ideas mainly. We never wrote together. It was just ideas. And one of the things we were pretty good about was kind of dividing up work, but because we had talked about what would be in that work in the first place, I don't think our books, if you read our books, you can never tell the part I wrote or the part Rick wrote. And that, in a lot of books that are co-authored, I think you can do that. I can pick up a book, and even some books that Rick's co-authored, I can see, well, this is a piece he wrote, and this is a piece he wrote, or she wrote. But because we'd talked through the, and we're basically, I think, pretty creative about thinking about all that, that when it came out, it was us. It wasn't either Rick or it wasn't me. We used to laugh a lot. And although we'd laugh about it, it's true. I can't think of really anything much in my professional life, and I don't think Rick could either, that you would say, well, this is Rick's, this is Bob's. I think the word we would use is ours. And as the years went by, Jeff, I think that's the way you and I and Rick were. I mean, I've often said, and I've told you this, that, you know, we could have, Rick and I could have written all that, but if we hadn't had the same thing happen in the relationship with you, there'd be a big warehouse full of books in Bloomington somewhere. Because you do have to get, you know, people do underestimate, I think. You can have a great book, but if it's not edited, published, marketed, promoted, supported, you know, that's, it sits on your a wife's bedside table, not that she'd read it, but still.
So Professional Learning Communities at Work came out in 1998, actually came out in the late fall of 97 with a 98 publication date. But you two had met in 78. Mm-hmm. So now it's been 20 years.
Before Bill
before the book came out. And then when he moved to Stevenson, so your laboratory at Stevenson was not a one semester, 1 year, not even a decade long. You're almost two full decades of implementing the best practices that you could find.
Right, right. And a good example, I think a good example of that is in the initial professional learning community books and writings and articles, one of the threads that cut through all those books was a collaborative culture of professional people working together. Well, what we, over a period of years at Stevenson, the issue is how do you do that? What is the day in and day out structure? So we started with the whole idea of teams. Let's organize in collaborative teams. We already had kind of departments, so that was easy enough to do. So we had teams, but some people didn't want to work on teams. So I never forget the first year. And by the way, intellectually, this is a real intellectual sort of tug of war here between two ideas. The first efforts at Stevenson, we invited people to be on teams and collaborate. We encouraged them. We supported it. Everybody's in favor of it. It's just nobody would do it. You know, you'd have a handful here and there. And we quickly began to realize that collaboration by invitation doesn't work, that you had to. And by the way, there are still people. I was at a number of years ago, I was invited to do a meeting at the Wingspread Conference Center. And Frank Lloyd Wright's place, I think it's in Wisconsin. Anyway, my point is there was quite a debate. There was a professor there from Harvard and some other places. And there was a group at the table that insisted that collaboration is only successful when people voluntarily want to be part of a collaborative culture that you can't. And I and Rick and we took right the opposite approach, that if as long as you say our school culture is going to be dependent on people who might want to you know, jump in and do it, then, you know, you're going to have pockets of collaboration, pockets of sort of PLC work. So then the next step, when we went from, well, everybody will be on a team, that raises a logical question. What are teams going to do? I mean, shouldn't we have some consistency here in terms of, you can't just say everybody's got to be on a team, go collaborate. And that's where we began to get back into that effective schools research. And you know, pulling that, for example, in all the effective schools research, there's this emphasis on, you know, essentially articulating clearly what the expectations are for kids to learn. Bob Marzano had just done, you know, guaranteed viable curriculum, all that stuff. So we said, well, the first things teams have to do is what? Let's clearly articulate what kids, what's essential for all kids to learn in the first place. So that first question that all teams would have to address, that didn't just, wasn't like we were just having a Coca-Cola one day and said, hey, here's an idea. It's interesting, just the journey to get to something that simple. And where we really, really were lucky, I think, was Paul Black, and Dylan Willems, and others were really beginning to say, hey, this formative assessment, assessing along the way, is a big deal, could be a powerful tool in a teacher's toolbox. And so that led to, well, teams should also, if we know what we want kids to learn, wouldn't teams need to have a way of saying, well, how will we know if they're learning along the way? And so that led to all the formative assessment stuff.
But that paper wasn't written until 1998.
Yeah, but the paper wasn't written. But if you think about it, and I think this was really, really something we was unique maybe to us at any rate. You think about sports. We talked a lot about sports. And in most of our books, like Professional Learning Communities at Work, at least half of that book comes from disciplines other than education. The world of business, the world of sports, right? And we give examples. Well, what's one of the just fundamental pillars of coaching? Scrimmaging. Checking along the way to see if kids are ready before the summative assessment, the game, right? So we began to see that a logical shift schools need to make was let's don't teach kids and then give an end-of-unit test to see if they got it or not. Let's teach kids and then check along the way to see if they're getting it. And so that was a forerunner. Rick and I were calling it formative assessment. So really what, for us, Dylan Willems and Paul Black did was label what we had figured out.
Validated.
And that's what I mean by that sort of lab experience.
Right.
We figured all that out in the real world of Stevenson and reading a lot. Rick and I both are just avid readers. And you've seen us. We do go on trips together, the families, and what are we doing? We're reading and talking and sharing. And so, and then, of course, that led to the obvious question. At Stevenson, this was huge, a huge thing. And one of the first schools, I think, really to think through this in an organized way. Well, what are we going to do if kids aren't learning? It's one thing just to know they aren't learning, determine they aren't learning. So it raises that same thing back in clinical supervision. So what? Yeah, I know that. They know that. So what are we going to do? And Rick was very, very, very clever. He would we'd go out to work with schools, and I just distinctly remember we'd ask this question. So tell me, when kids are experiencing difficulty, how does your school respond? And almost invariably people would say things, oh, we got some great teachers. They go to extraordinary lengths, and they'd give examples. And Rick would say, no, that wasn't my question. You're telling me how individual teachers respond. How does your school respond? And what we discovered is nearly all, very few schools had a school response. They relied on an individual teacher. So that led to this whole idea at Stevenson. And, of course, I guess there's some need to label things, but we thought that response should be systematic, school-wide response that would be layered. Well, first we try this. If that doesn't work, then we try this. If that doesn't work, we try this. I mean, kind of relentless levels of responses. And I don't know when exactly we put a label on it, but we called it a pyramid of interventions, because here's what we do first. Then as you work your way up the pyramid, and that, guess what comes along after that? RTI. So it's just a series of good fortune, really, that happened in my life.
Well, I don't know if it's good fortune as much as it's that when opportunity meets preparation, you were well prepared.
Yeah, well, we were able to see that things build on things, you know.
Yeah.
And hopefully, and I've been really, Jeff, I think we're all blessed to see the generation of educators that have come along, and they're picking up the mantle, and that have added to the PLC concepts and practices that Rick and I build off of other people. So it's not that people own ideas, I don't think. I think we all just build on each other. That's what the world of science is really supposed to be. You know, we just keep building on building a knowledge base. And we have one of the nice things about Solution Tree and other companies as it's grown. All this continues to grow and develop. And we know more than we've ever known about how to improve schools.
Sure. So 1998, 20 years later, we lose Rick, basically. Mm-hmm. So you have a friendship of 40 years that you guys worked together, wrote together, traveled together, vacationed together. That's quite a friendship.
Yeah. Well, you went through this also, but it was such a shattering thing for me in terms of I felt like, and I still do, that part of my physical body is gone, maybe like my arms or my legs or something, because at least half of what I did was Rick. You know, people even referred to us as Rick and Bob, or Rick and Bob this, or Rick and Bob that, or, you know. And so one day you have that, the next day you don't. And that's been a heck of a loss. I mean, people can imagine. It's like, we just thought of ourselves as family, really.
Yeah.
But you experienced the same.
Yeah.
Thing.
You know, it was a life lost way too young for nothing that he didn't try to prevent along the way.
Just, yeah.
It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Bob.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Treehouse today. If you have an author or a topic to suggest for a future podcast, reach out to me directly at jeff.jones@solutiontree.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you for all that you do.